are you?
I'm Batman.
Welcome, podcast listeners of Gotham, to the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, look at the entire Batman franchise.
To the Batmobile! This could be the break we've been looking for!
Join Dark Knight Garrett Collins.
You look fine.
I didn't ask.
Boy Wonder Matthew Goudreau.
This is why Superman works alone.
And the world's greatest podcast detective, Adam Bunch.
Loose to plague us with his criminal conundrums.
As they look at most of the cinematic incarnations of Gotham's favorite vigilante crime fighter.
You must be joking.
Do I look like I'm joking?
From the Adam West, Burt Ward starring Batman 66.
Some days you just can't get rid of a bomb.
To Tim Burton's late 80s, early 90s take.
I believe the word you're looking for.
All the way through Matt Reeves, Robert Pattinson starring The Batman.
2 years of nights have turned me into a nocturnal animal.
These podcasters take the Rogues Gallery journey through one of the most popular comic book franchises of all time.
This town needs an enema.
So start up your podcast mobile.
Fortune smiles, another day of wine and roses. Or in your case, beer and pizza. Ha!
And make sure your butler doesn't let your girlfriend in on the secret.
Has anybody ever told you you have a serious impulse control problem?
That the percolated media Batman retrospective begins now.
Let's kick some ice.
Batman and Robin. Released June 20th, 1997. Budget on this was $160 million. Box office, $238.2 million. And this was once again directed by Joel Schumacher. Well, boys, if Batman 89 launched a new era of comic book films, films that included The Rocketeer, we got The Shadow, we got Dick Tracy, we got a slew of just big-time comic book films, thanks to 89's Batman's success, I like to think. Batman and Robin took that fad and drove it right into the cooler, if we can say it that far.
Yeah, insert pun here about this cratering, not just this franchise, but this set. Well, it's actually difficult because you have to remember Blade came out a year after this.
It started a whole
new
era. It did,
but as far as this, the era that Richard Donner's Superman started, I think this is the end of that era, and we shifted into, I wouldn't call it the modern era of superhero movies, because even Blade through now has gone through a lot of changes, but this was the death of the old approach for well-documented reasons, because of all the movies we've reviewed in the near decade we've been doing this, this might be the most infamous movie we have ever done, as far as... It doesn't need any introduction, although we're going to give one. The movie's reputation precedes itself. But goddamn, like, this is one of the most famous turkeys that Hollywood has ever produced. And how apropos we are reviewing this. Tomorrow will make 25 years since this released.
Wow. 25 years. 25 years since my very first pre-screening, my very first huge screening that I went to in San Francisco. Was Batman and Robin. I went to a screening with Clooney. Arnold was there. Uma was there. There was a huge, huge outpouring of positive vibes going on. And once that screening was over, man, let's just say it was something to behold. Mr. Bunch?
Yes, sir.
You, the one who was friends with me around this time. You know what? I don't really remember us really talking about Batman Forever, except for immediately afterwards. What were you thinking with Batman and Robin? Were you excited for it?
Going into it, you know, it was a couple years after Batman Forever. At the time, I was really, you know, I enjoyed that movie quite a bit. For this one, Yeah, I mean, you got Arnold Schwarzenegger, you got George Clooney. I was very high on ER. I loved him on that at the time. I think that first season is fantastic. Chris O'Donnell, whatever, he was coming back. But, you know, we were getting Batgirl. We were getting Poison Ivy. So going in, the expectation was pretty dang high because marketing, the ads, everything else. Like, it looked campy, it looked a little goofy, but it looked like they were definitely bringing some money, some budget, and some stars out to play this time.
So, Matt, when you were going through the Batman movies, was this the first one you watched, or was it Batman Forever?
This was the first one I watched, because really...
Oh, jeez.
Well, there's plenty of reasons. Number one, it was the most recent of the ones that were available to me, so that was easier, and you couldn't escape the VHS copies of this at my age, along with all the toys and all that crap, so it made sense, knowing... What I know now, I certainly would not have made this the first one if I had my way as a child. But like I said on the Forever show, this I have seen an ungodly amount of times, mostly from my YouTube. Prior to this viewing, I couldn't tell you the last time I sat down without skipping around or fast-forwarding and watched this from beginning to end. And full transparency, I had to do this in two viewings. There's a point in this movie where I had to stop it and just... take some time for myself, relax, and finish it out. But yeah, as a kid, I couldn't get enough of this movie.
Wow, so it's like Goonies for you. Like, you loved it as a kid, and then because this is Goonies for me. But I watched it when I get older. I'm like, oh, boy, that was noisy. Let's go a little bit into the making of this, because like last week, the casting is that takes on a whole nother life. Before we get to the casting, you know, we mentioned last week, people say what they want about Batman Forever. We all didn't say two positive things, even though Matt did. But that movie was a massive hit. They obviously weren't going to go back to Burton. They knew they had their window dresser Schumacher in the can, so he was all set to come back. But when Schumacher came back, and, you know, you listen to the man's commentaries, and he is a very affable guy. Matt mentioned this last week.
Oh, yeah.
We can say what we will about his movies. We'll say a lot about this one tonight. But the thing about Schumacher that everybody can agree on is the man was a very affable, very likable guy. And, you know, you never heard a real bad word about him personally. And you listen to his commentaries, and he comes off very, very affable. But... I don't know how much I believe him, because if you listen to his commentary for this movie, he mentions that the movie he was trying to make was what Nolan eventually made 8 years later. Matt, how much do you believe that?
About as much as I believe that Arnold Schwarzenegger was the best choice to play Mr. Freeze, which is to say not very much.
Especially when you have, you know, Akiva Goldsman was back as screenwriter, and he was the screenwriter last week. It's hard for me to think about. Adam, what about you, sir? I mean, did you hear that? Do you believe that at all?
I don't know. It's, you know, the commentary I've caught in part of, but his more like the behind-the-scenes interviews, viewings, stuff like that. Like, I believe the guy. I like the guy. I think what he initially was setting out to make is not what he was allowed to make. I think their turnaround time, being rushed so quick, which caused them to lose, you know, their star. And an 11th-hour decision. It's funny watching a back and forth on behind the scenes and watching Kilmer and Schumacher get cut back and forth. Neither one of them blaming each other, but both of them blaming each other for it. So I think he had some respect for the property, but I think he was kind of hamstrung by a lot of the decisions that were forced upon him. The first one being, I think this one is run even more so than the last one by not only Mattel, but I don't know, Fox Animation. It's kind of what part of it feels like.
Yes, absolutely. Mattel was a big part, because Mattel was, if you listen to Schumacher, what he says is he goes to a meeting and the very first thing they do is they plop a toy Batmobile on the table and say, this is what your Batmobile is going to look like. You did very well for us last time. You made us a lot of money. We're going to carry on with that. And this is where the term toyetic came from, was where Schumacher walked into something that wasn't a movie as much as it was just an advertisement for toys, an advertisement for credit cards, you know, everything else in between. And it's really interesting to think about, like, okay, what did he have in mind and what actually came out of those meetings? And, you know, this was also the era Nicolas Cage and Tim Burton were trying to make a Superman film. And in a lot of ways, I think this movie killed those plans, because that movie ended up not coming out. And who knows how the hell that would have turned out. But you look at that movie and you look at the way Nicolas Cage's suit glowed and everything else. That was the result of what was going on with Batman at that time. Just really, really strange to think about. But they geared up, and you know, we'll talk about casting, but Schumacher had Arnold in mind, and they signed this guy for $25 million.
In 97.
And what they got from him was, yeah, in 97. I mean, 97, and we'll talk about it, but that was the downward slide to his career. We'll talk about it when we get into the movie. But they paid for 6 weeks of work and 27 puns. It was what they got for $25 million. All right. You know what? There's so much to talk about with this movie. We'll get behind the scenes as we get into it, because when you talk about casting, there's a lot to talk about. Boys, are you ready to dive into Batman and Robin?
Well, I don't really have a choice in this matter, so let's let's dive into this this movie.
All right. So we open up with the Warner Brothers logo. It's frozen. And then it dissolves. So Burton's fight in 89 paid off here, because now every single one of these movies we're having the logo dissolve as it appears on screen. And then we get more of the Superman type credits that we talked about last week. And then the suit up scene. Right away, boys. I mean, come on. We got a suit up scene complete with not one, but two shots of each codpiece and each ass in this suit. Oh, boy. We already know this is a different film, right, guys?
Okay, you know what? I mean, I actually really like the opening logo. I think it looks pretty cool. But, yes, kind of right here, very first couple shots, they're letting you know what you're going to get. And it's going to be bat-ass times two, bat-dong times two, bat-nips times four. I mean, it's before we see anything else, before we see our characters, before we see our players, we see the bat-ass, the bat-dong, and the bat-nips. And holy shit! You know, I want an interview with the editor that decided how this thing was going to be cut together, because it's an interesting way to start a film. I'll give it that.
Film geared towards children, nonetheless.
It's fascinating to me that this is very different from the opening of Forever, but it's also very much the same general idea, just cranked up to 11, which could be the thesis statement of this entire movie. Summarizing everything is just taking what we've done before because we were successful and pushing it as far as we can. We got double the bat suits, we got double the gadgets, double the ass shots, like you said. And while you called it a different movie, I would disagree with that to a certain extent, because some of these plot points and similarities are bordering on taking the Forever script, scribbling it out in crayon and making some tweaks just to claim it as different. So I'm not going to say this is a terrible way to start the movie, because like Adam said, I love the logo they came up with. But I'd be lying if I said that I find this fetishistic to a fault, and I say that as a gay man.
So we see the Batmobile, it's steaming, and then Robin says he wants a car because
it's a steaming pile. I'm sorry to cut you off right there.
Oh, it's good.
Adam complained a lot about the Batmobile in last week's discussion, and this may be the worst thing in it, is the way this thing fucking looks. The front blue spiraling turbine, I hate this. Mm-hmm. There is not a worse Batmobile in any iteration, including freaking just like knockoff online animated movie. This thing is abysmal, and it's here for one reason, to sell a freaking toy, but damn, this thing's ugly.
Is it worse than the Tumbler?
Yeah, you know what? The Tumbler, I didn't like at first. You know, I was known for calling it the Bat SUV, and I kind of stick by that.
Mm-hmm.
But I hate the look of this thing. I mean, I guess on the bright side, the fins don't wobble like they do in Forever, but there is nothing. To me, this does not scream Batmobile in any way, shape, or form. Batman Brave and the Bold. Diedrich Bader's Batman would be embarrassed to drive this freaking Batmobile.
So would Adam West. He'd be like, well, see here, old chum. This is nothing conspicuous at all about this particular piece of equipment.
Matt, how do you feel about the Batmobile here?
I'm with Adam. I hate this car aesthetically. All right. Here's the deal. This movie should be directed by the toy company. That should be the first credit. I did own this particular model. And
oh, wow.
Even as a kid, it was the flimsiest piece of plastic that turbine in the front that Adam alluded to was not even colored correctly, to my knowledge. I think it was just a spinning disc, but there was no light or projector inside of it. Mm-hmm. So it just looked incredibly stupid without any color. Speaking of color, let's be honest. This is Day Glow, the movie. And it starts right...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if we thought last week had a lot of neon, oh boy. My God, does he go overboard with it here. Robin then says that he wants a car because, you know what, guys? Chicks dig the car.
Chicks dig the car.
And that's when Batman says this is why Superman works alone. And this is when we are introduced to our new Batman, ER's George Clooney. Much like Val Kilmer, we seem to be reviewing a lot of ER alums this year. How do we feel about George Clooney as Batman? If I were to start off here... At this point, he was not known for much. He had done From Dusk Till Dawn 2 years before. And you know what? When Val Kilmer fell through, and say what you will about what they thought about of each other, but according to Schumacher, he tried getting him back for this. This is Clooney just out of his element. Out of his element. I do not like him in this at all.
I'm going to go. I think he's a pretty crappy Batman, but I think part of that is this suit, the ears. There's nothing of him in the suit that does him justice whatsoever. Him as Bruce Wayne, I don't think he's the worst Bruce Wayne, other than him doing the Clooney, which even American Dad fucking makes fun of this. He's constantly lowering his head, sheepishly looking up at you with the Clooney grin on his face, that he can't stop doing it. He takes a shit with that look on his face.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, like the few moments that he actually gets to emote, you know, a little bit with a little bit of concern and gravitas throughout the movie, which is rare. But when he does, he's got some talent. But the rest of this, I think he's still finding his style of acting, and it doesn't really get suited to what should be in a Batman. Well, it belongs in this Batman film. It doesn't really belong in a Batman universe. But I can't believe it, but I think he may be a better choice than what we had last week.
Wow. Bold statement.
From me, who loves Val Kilmer, I'm saying that.
Yeah, it's shocking.
I'm going to make an even more provocative statement. In a movie this bad, I think George Clooney is the absolute worst thing in it. He looks like a perpetual deer in the headlights for this entire movie.
he has no idea what side he's on.
He has no clue what he's doing. And I think Batman Forever, we talked about this, how the acting styles are all over the place. This one has that to an extent, but Clooney's take was that he does not have one at all. He's not giving a performance. He's just, they put him in the bat suit, which I can imagine was a nightmare, as everyone has talked about outside of Christian Bale for The Dark Knight, basically. That discomfort shows, but he's just... He doesn't have a take. He's just awkward. He can't deliver the one-liners. Not that a lot of people could with this dialogue. He does not have any chemistry with Chris O'Donnell. And I get the sense that Chris O'Donnell could kick his ass, which is not something that you want for your Robin-Batman relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But this was Clooney. Even in that bat cowl, he cannot keep his goddamn head straight. And that thing is designed for you to be immobile. And he still found a way to keep that head bobbing. And to quote George Clooney himself, he said that doing Out of Sight right after this taught him how to act again. Because this movie, you watch this, and it is amazing this guy has become the star that he is, transcending this performance. Because this is the kind of role that, or the kind of performance that could kill your career. I don't think this is the perfect example, but there's a reason why George Clooney is referred to as the George Lazenby of the Batman. not just because they're both named George, but they are the... I can't agree with Adam when he's the worst Bruce Wayne. But or a better Bruce Wayne than... He's not the worst. That just blows my mind. But I will say this. If they ever do Dark Knight Returns as a straight-up adaptation... The first person I would call is George Clooney and say, hey, do you want another shot at the title? Because I think he could definitely do it now. And I'd love to see him redeem himself in a way, because he jokes about this all the time, that he killed Batman, and he apologizes for it routinely. But all in all, I do have to place blame on him as a performer, because he doesn't seem to have a take. But I also recognize that he was set up to fail. And... Fail spectacularly, dare I say.
You know, to piggyback on what Matt just said, You know, people say this movie almost wrecked his career. I say this movie is why he is the star he would eventually become. Because he said, and Adam, you and I used to watch Letterman all the time. He would go on Letterman like the week the movie came out and said, look, this movie sucks, and I suck in it.
Very famously, like, yes, he did. He really did.
Big on that. He did it on the Dennis Miller. Remember me and you used to watch the Dennis Miller HBO show? Yep. And he did it right on that show, too. And he has also been known to refund people who tell him that they saw this in the theater.
Yep. If you say you saw it in theaters, he'll pay you back $10 for seeing it.
He'll pay you back the money. He has the perfect movie star attitude. And this is why we love him. And if it wasn't for this movie, he wouldn't become what he eventually became. And I think you're right, Matt. Even though I have never seen Out of Sight, I know that's very terrible to say, but I never saw that movie.
Lucky.
But yeah, I've read that too, where he said doing Out of Sight really redeemed his love for acting again. But the way he handled this is why he's a star.
What's amazing to Clooney is in between this movie, you realize he was bookended by starring in a movie with two women who were in other Batman movies. Right before this, he did One Fine Day with Michelle Pfeiffer. And right after it, he did The Peacemaker with Nicole Kidman. This guy's been just
I'd never put that together.
All over the place. And I think it was only a couple months after this, you and I went to a screening in San Francisco of The Thin Red Line, which was him really doing something different with Terrence Malick.
Mm-hmm.
It's good that he found Steven Soderbergh, because those movies you mentioned, this included, he was not on a good trajectory because...
No, he would have been stuck there.
One Fine Day, he would have been Gerard Butler, basically.
Yep. Good call. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I've never seen ER, so I cannot speak. I know of its reputation. I know it by association. But I saw Peacemaker. I saw One Fine Day. I don't even like From Dusk Till Dawn. So to me, this just fit in line with the garbage. He must have had a different agent. I swear to God, him and Dominic West have the same agent. Because Dominic West has the best TV credits of all time between The Wire and some of the other stuff he's done. And you look at his movie career, it is a disaster for the most part.
We see Alfred not feeling well as Robin drives away. We are then introduced to Mr. Freeze, played by a very punny Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Starts off with a pun.
Now, as I said at the beginning of this podcast, Arnold was paid a lot of money to do this movie. And what needs to be said is, this was the end of his run. 4 years before, he had his first big flop, Last Action Hero. No big deal. Everybody has a flop, even if it takes a while. He had then gone on to do James Cameron's True Lies, a modest hit. But he faltered here, to the point where 1997 was the year he had heart surgery, and after Batman and Robin, he wouldn't have another big film until End of Days, because no one was willing to insure him. Matt, as the guy who loves impressions and puns and loves Arnold Schwarzenegger, you must be wondering where his gold statue is for this, right?
I think he's wondering the same thing right now, along with a variety of other questions. But here's the thing. Even though his star power was fading, he still received top billing by a considerable margin, which is telling in multiple ways. Number one, Joel Schumacher said he wanted Schwarzenegger because he said Mr. Freeze should look like he's built like out of a glacier, I think was his quote or something similar. I get getting Schwarzenegger. He's larger than life. So putting him in a Batman movie that's not a stretch. What is a stretch is casting him as Mr. Freeze. Granted, the character had gone through a renaissance with the animated series about 5 years before, where they took a character who, this version is very much like the 60s show, where he was played by three different actors. And I don't think half of Schwarzenegger could match the three of them, to be perfectly honest, in the range department. So that version, I could see what Schumacher and company are pulling from. But the fact that they pull his origin from the animated series, it's incorporated here, and it's pretty streamlined. There's some things that are removed, but it shows that they were cognizant of what had happened with this character, which, much like Two-Face in the previous movie, makes it all the more painful to watch. Added to the fact that he's only spoken puns, Schwarzenegger is a parody of himself in this movie. And I love Arnold, but... he's simultaneously the best thing about this movie and one of the worst, because he's indicative of the problem that no one really took this as seriously as they should. And I like to say something nice. I love the suit. I think they did a good job of coming up with something kind of, it's robotic. The suit's always been tough to do in live action because it's a lot bulkier because it's fucking Arnold. And I think they did a good job of painting him with that acrylic blue skin disorder that he has. But I'd be lying if I said this was a good performance. I don't know if I could call it. I think Clooney is worse because at least Schwarzenegger, you can say, hey, he was told have fun. Be like the 60s show. Be yourself. But unfortunately, much like Tommy Lee Jones, it's at the expense of a character that had gone through a great run of becoming a very soulful villain. And that's not here. And if it is, nobody was paying attention in the writing department.
You know, Ben Richards from The Running Man watched this movie and said, holy shit, this guy's got a lot of puns. Sorry, for those that don't know, that was Arnold Schwarzenegger, The Running Man. Okay.
we'll be covering it in a couple years. Don't worry. We'll be getting to it.
I agree with Matt that I think he looks great. And his skin, the way it's painted, the few times we get it close up, I'm impressed by the way it looks and the makeup and everything else. However, Arnold made sure that his makeup time was part of his max hours on set every day. When you have a director say he's not going to make this movie unless you're in it, and if you don't do it, he's just going to walk away from the movie and you can demand anything you want, Arnold got to demand whatever he wanted, and he sure got it. Behind the scenes tells you that if you don't see him speaking, that is not Arnold you're seeing on screen. Chris O'Donnell famously said, yeah, I spent all this time with Arnold on the set, and we never were on screen at the same time. We never got filmed at the same time. If I was Paul Dini, writer, one of the creators of Batman the Animated Series, I would dropkick Akiva Goldsman out of the fucking ring for what he did after I took Victor Freeze and made one of the best episodes ever of animation. They didn't borrow, they stole so liberally for what they did to this character, and the few little parts we get of an icy cold heart is just so watered down that it's, the thought process is there, but, you know, much like an iceberg, so much is under the surface we never get to see. It sucks because I would love for them to do Mr. Freeze proper now, but I'm also really tired of seeing the same villains in every single movie. For what this movie is, yeah, I mean, I don't know who else you'd get to play the role because he's right for this version of Victor Freeze. He's top billed in the movie. He's the one that the marketing was all done for and everything else. I agree. The suit looks great. His machinations, his plots, his we're going to steal diamonds is as stupid as could be. But to me, this movie starts to become a live-action version of the cartoon right here the second that he shows up.
Wasn't this earmarked, Matt, for Patrick Stewart?
A lot of the fans wanted Patrick Stewart. That was something that the studio never bought it into. Apparently the three names that were considered were Patrick Stewart, Ed Harris, and Anthony Hopkins. All three of those would not have worked as this version of Mr. Freeze. If you were doing Heart of Ice, absolutely I could see an Ed Harris or an Anthony Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
With that said, apparently Schwarzenegger's big rival, Stallone, was doing everything in his power to try to get this role.
Oh.
The studio likely said no, because much like Schwarzenegger, his career was on the down. It was on the avalanche of coming, and he could not outrun it on his skis.
To piggyback on what both you guys said, I remember, you know, I was working at a grocery store around the time this movie was coming out. I remember seeing pictures of this costume in E! Weekly, maybe People Magazine, one of those. And I loved the look. I think it was a picture of him, like, holding the diamond or something. And I was like, excited might be too high praise, but I was intrigued by whether he could boost another bad guy after the Terminator. Mm-hmm. You know, because he famously said after the Terminator, look, I don't want to play another bad guy again. Because these good guy roles are where most of the money is. But he was given that $25 million paycheck, and he took this. Even if I was intrigued by what the costume would be, the second he appears on screen, he's just a totally different character than the one I was envisioning from those pictures.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think this version of Mr. Freeze, I'm not going to say he's terrible. I think he's fine. I don't think they got what they paid for with him, because he's playing it big with many puns, and I'm not really buying him as Mr. Freeze anyway. So he's just being Arnold.
Oh, yeah. That's what you're getting at. Yeah. You know, it's amazing that the year before, and why I would have been excited, I think it was Eraser came out like a year and a half before this movie. And that was a different kind of take for Arnold because he was a person doing that. And it's, I remember really, really enjoying that movie, kind of like True Lies. Huge fan of True Lies. So I thought he was going to be just back in an action way. And this is not action star Arnold. This is just show up on screen in a funny costume and be funny.
He's not helped by being surrounded by skateboards and troops that Robin would say are the hockey team from hell. Like,
he's on the ice capades.
It's a very, yeah, as Tim Burton would call it, the gay ice capades. He was just in a silly, silly movie. So there was no way he could expand what he was trying to do here. It just comes off as weird. We're seeing a diamond being hit by hockey sticks, and this is a scene just as loud as last week's opener. But is it just me, or does it seem even louder? And I cannot believe I'm saying this, but I'm kind of wishing we were back in a safe with acid coming and falling into it, because this is just, wow, is it loud.
It's not just loud. It is also technically less proficient. If you notice, this movie has some of the worst wire work you will ever see in a major theatrical release around this time. From Batman trying to slide down that dinosaur, to Robin pole vaulting, to Robin trying to get onto the rocket. All of the stunt work is very noticeable, and all the wire work is so off-putting that this looks like a Batman on ice that you would see at Six Flags. Mm-hmm. Or at an amusement park. That's what this is echoing, and it's not.
Yeah,
it's you can make, and it's funny I'm going to say this considering what Batman has become after this. I think you can make a Batman movie that is this aesthetically bright and a comedy if it's done correctly. I think it's about time Batman takes the piss out of himself again on screen. Not to preview my thoughts too much, because we still have plenty of conversations, but it's not that a funny Batman movie should not be made. It's that if you're going to do that, you need to have a word that clearly these producers did not have: moderation and restraints. This has neither of those things, which is why it is as unrelentingly obnoxious as it is.
We get this diamond just going everywhere until it lands and freezes hands. As Batman and Robin, they skate with the troops. And Robin, he straps himself onto Freeze's ship as Batman fights him on the inside. And then Freeze hits him with the freeze ray. And then Mr. Freeze says that he's going to leave Batman as he freezes in space. So here's Robin, just back from just hanging around. He frees Batman, and they rig it to explode as they leave. And this shot of them on their hoverboards as it explodes was in all the promo clips leading up to this film. I remember it very, very well. They land as Robin yells, "Cowabunga!"
Oh, wrong franchise, dipshit.
Yeah, he left his nunchucks in the Batcave.
What a dick, Robin.
Freeze gets him with his freeze ray and calls him Bird Boy. Batman saves him by heating him up. And this was the part when I was like, okay, this is like having a shark repellent, where Batman actually has a thing that actually it heats up ice. Like, this is just weird to me that he would have a device for
everything. Random heat laser right in his utility belt.
There it
is. You know what? The laser pointer that he would have used for Catwoman. That's what it is.
Not to question the scientific accuracy of this movie, but one of my favorite things to talk about is that Mr. Freeze launches a rocket, and the amount of exhaust that requires would have killed every single person in that museum.
Also, can we not just talk about how funny it is that there's no pun made about Dick riding a rocket? I mean, it's right there.
Especially with how phallic that rocket is.
Absolutely. No kidding. Yeah. We then cut to who will eventually be our Poison Ivy.
Smash cut. You want to talk about an awkward edit job? Holy shit.
Miss Isley, played by Uma Thurman. Now, Adam knows, I went through a number of years where Uma was on top of my to-do list.
Went through, yes.
To put it bluntly. I had the Pulp Fiction poster on my wall, and this woman was as glamorous as they came for me. Now, I definitely don't feel as strong in that way. But I look at her, especially in this movie, and feel, yes, sometimes you are very, very pretty. But there are others when she looks about as unglamorous as they come. Like, she just looks awkward. now that I got the superficial stuff out of the way, I'll say that she looks like she's having a blast in this movie and really seems like she can't give two fucks what people say about this movie or her in it. But she is not a good fit as Poison Ivy. How do we feel about Uma Thurman in this, boys?
Oh, boy. She's committed. I'll say that. That's the nicest way I can put this. I don't understand her desire to do a Mae West impression throughout this entire movie. It is Mae West mixed with Betty Davis after a stroke, mixed with slutty Kim Cattrall from Sex and the City.
Jesus.
Having said that, much like the variety of toxins that are flowing through her body after a certain point, I think she knows the kind of movie she's in, and that's why she's being as theatrical as she is playing this up. I have never liked Poison Ivy outside of when she's with Harley Quinn. That's really the only time to me that they have made that character anything beyond just a fetishistic fantasy for teenage boys who read these comics. It's so weird that they paired Mr. Freeze and Poison Ivy in the same movie. That is the strangest combination I think you'll ever see of doing the dueling villains in Batman, because their goals are entirely antithetical to one another, which makes this movie all the more dumb and all the more cartoony. But I can't blame Uma Thurman. She is doing what she is asked to do, and looking at the people considered, you probably would have gotten the same performance as well, considering that they wanted either Demi Moore, Sharon Stone, or Julia Roberts.
Oh, I know that Schumacher really vied for Julia Roberts because he had just worked with her on Dying Young, but she was like, you know what, you almost killed my career with Dying Young. I don't want to work with you again.
Well, I guess Uma Thurman was cast because Schumacher loved her and Baron Munchausen.
Oh, interesting.
Which he homages that movie definitely by the end of this one.
Oh, God, yes.
Yep. It's strange that Uma's in some movies that I absolutely adore, but I'm going to say it, and I'm going to say it at the risk of pissing off one of my co-hosts here, she's not a good actress. You know, she's in some great movies. She could do some good things. I love her as The Bride. Those are some of my favorite movies from Quentin. But, I mean, one, let's give her credit. This is one of the few people who's been in an Avengers movie and a Batman movie. Agreed, it's the wrong Avengers, but let's not forget she was Emma Peel, and I paid to see that in the movie theater. You know, but outside of something like Gattaca, I can't say that her acting has won me over, you know, in a lot of movies. But she's a presence at this time with her up and coming, with what she's had. I feel like she was a get, especially after Pulp Fiction. It's amazing that she didn't do better movies between Pulp Fiction and this, really. Would she do freaking Truth About Cats and Dogs and some of that type of stuff? She was going down the Clooney route. But she's, as Matt says, she's having fun, you know? She's just like, screw it. I'm going to be in some outfits. I'm going to hoot and holler, and I'm going to have a good old time. And I think that's kind of what she does throughout.
Prior to Pulp Fiction, she did a movie that I've always found to be underrated, a movie called Jennifer 8, where she played a blind lady who's actually a witness to a crime.
Ooh, yeah.
And I thought she was really good in that.
Yeah,
and
she is really good
in
that.
Yeah, she can do it, but she did get stuck in that route of just doing these glamorous parts, and she never really lived up to the potential I thought that she could have lived up to. I think she got stuck being, quote-unquote, Quentin's girl, you know, after Pulp Fiction and doing the Kill Bill movies and being stuck in that whole route. And, you know, you read stuff that she talks about, you know, after the Me Too movement. There was a lot going on there that we never knew until she started talking about it. If you want to, just go ahead, take a shower, and then read some of the stuff that she said since then. It's not pretty, folks. But I am totally with you guys where I don't feel like she's good in this movie, but at least she commits. And that's the best I can say about it.
But I don't know who you would have got. Like Matt says, I do think that Poison Ivy works best with Harley Quinn. If you watch the animated Harley Quinn series that's on HBO Max, season 2, I think, is phenomenal. And Lake Bell voices Poison Ivy. She is stupendous. She is absolutely the right deadpan version of that character. She is great as Poison Ivy. And let's just say Poison Ivy and Alicia Silverstone, same movie, crossing over, Two-Face. This is all coming together, folks.
Schumacher always cakes her in green light for obvious reasons. And she kind of, Matt, is it just me or does she kind of feel like Enigma here, where she always has the glasses on when we see her prior? And, you know, we're going to see her transform in a little bit. Oh, I kind of got a few Enigma feelings before John Glover appears on screen. What about you, Matt? Did you feel that? Is that what Schumacher was going for here?
That's what I was alluding to about this movie basically kind of being a remake of Batman Forever. You have the opening is fighting the villain who's already established, followed by the nerdy scientist, borderline, not a stalker, but she's, you know, reborn, so to speak, and goes after Bruce Wayne. Literally, the scene where she confronts Bruce Wayne is written identically to the Enigma confrontation where she presents this ethically controversial plan to, you know, save the world, like manipulating brainwaves. Bruce Wayne rejects her, and she becomes a supervillain. So it's the same plot outline, just with a different character. Rumor is, for the longest time, it was not going to be Poison Ivy, but they wanted to do Scarecrow alongside Mr. Freeze, which is where the science component. But apparently Schumacher was the one really pushing for a female villain, because there were not a lot really there at this time.
Any idea who was going to be Scarecrow?
No idea. It was more names were thrown out with the hypothetical fifth movie. Canonically, there's someone in this movie who is apparently Scarecrow.
That's what I was getting to, but I guess we'll get to it. So, speaking of another new villain, we see John Glover create our first on-screen version of Bane.
Do you know who John Glover is? Because he is a major villain in the DC Universe. Dr. Woodrue. That is the Floronic Man.
Oh, boy. I don't know what to say about this lunatic thug henchman that they turned Bane into here, except I remember the grumbling about this character even then. Even though there was an internet, but it was very, very new. But I do remember even reading on message boards then, like, what the fuck is this thing they call Bane? This is not Bane.
Monkey work.
My goodness, this is just bad. I don't know. What was Schumacher thinking? Like, we're trying to get as many villains in this as we can, right? I mean, this is awful.
I don't understand the rationale. If you were going to look for Poison Ivy to have some heavy henchmen, just have her mind control security guards for the entire movie, which is lying with her motives. The crazy thing is that Bane was only around for about 4 years by the time this movie came out. He was one of the newest villains in Batman's canon, which is crazy that they used him so early, but yet did him so dirty. I have a lot of issues with Tom Hardy's Bane with writing. But both movies, he's under the thumb of a woman, which is also crazy. I mean, it's different because, you know, this movie, it's a green thumb because of Poison Ivy. But
oh,
it couldn't even get a guy who was overly cut. This guy, like, Jeep Swenson was a wrestler, but not exactly muscular in the way that Tom Hardy morphed himself. This is not Dave Bautista, oh boy, as far or even on the level of The Rock. This is one of the, you know, I get why people hate this version so much, and I can't bring myself to be that upset because I've got the comics to redeem Bane. Because in my mind, outside of Nightfall and some of his other appearances, Bane has not exactly gotten a lot of great stuff outside of his initial run. You know, Dark Knight Rises, there was a lot of potential that was ruined. Ironically, the best stuff for me was the Harley Quinn show, where he talks like Tom Hardy.
What are you doing sitting in my chair?
Yeah, I brought it up. He was fairly new at this time. The only reason I could think that they would have forced him in here is Nightfall was a huge arc, really sparked it. But yeah, he hasn't been done well in comics since, really. I mean, they did a City of Bane huge arc, I want to say 2 years ago in Batman Comics, that went on so long and got so dry that Tom King was kind of kicked off the book by the end of it. To me, it's Batman the Animated Series, I think, did a really good job with him. We talked about the Over the Edge episode where he shows up and he's just menacing and he's got the mask and a voice that's, you know, he taunts Batman, and what would you expect from a killer of children? I mean, Batista ripped with a luchador mask that maybe doesn't speak would be amazing. Unfortunately, Batista said he's not going to keep himself in shape now that he's mid-50s to do shirtless scenes anymore. I like Tom Hardy's idea for Bane, though it really comes down to like a alternate mutant leader from Dark Knight Rises, Dark Knight Returns. It's just a henchman. Matt brought it up. Poison Ivy can mind control. Go to Hush, where she can mind control Superman by wrapping him up with Ivy. Just get somebody with some vines around their neck and let them be your henchmen for a while. It's a waste of a character, and it was there. Let's be honest, it was there to sell some Bane toys. That's it.
Isley says that she has spent a lifetime protecting plants from extinction, and in order to protect his work, Glover topples her over and dumps all these toxins on her.
Including super soldier serum.
Yeah.
It is amazing that Marvel did not sue them, because that is a copyrighted phrase.
Yeah.
Super soldier serum.
Laura was walking through the room when that happened. He goes, and some super soldier serum. She turned around, went back in the room, and went, did he just... yep, yep, he did.
We get the familiar way of introducing villains as we're seeing video of Dr. Freeze becoming his mutated self while coming up with a solution to save his wife, as Alfred is just still not feeling well, and Bruce does not trust Robin to do the job as he requests more simulator training. But this is when the bickering between them really begins. Matt, I cannot help, since you mentioned it, just think about the copy-paste nature of this as opposed to last week. This way of seeing this villain be made is exactly how we saw Two-Face last week.
You know what's different? This is 10 times funnier because of Schwarzenegger's PBR. Yes. It's falling. Yeah. He's like, yeah. OSHA would have a field day with this science lab, because there's no fence around that. It's just this open pit of cryogenic fluid that, of course, he would fall into that. How else would you become a supervillain? It's not like Ferris Boyle, where he knocked him into some chemicals. Here, it's kind of your own fault, buddy, to a certain extent.
It's kind of the longstanding joke that Gotham doesn't need Batman. It needs some fucking OSHA regulations, goddammit.
Alfred is on Robin's side and asks him to trust Robin more, to which Bruce just says, good night, Alfred. And Clooney's Bruce Wayne, just, you guys mentioned it earlier, but just leaves a ton to be desired, doesn't it?
He looks good. Like, he looks... Well, Clooney looks like Bruce Wayne, especially then. Mm-hmm. You know, he's Clooney-tang. I mean, yeah. He looks the part, but he's no Michael Keaton.
Yeah. Yeah, that's saying a lot. We cut back to John Glover as Poison Ivy hatches, is grown. What exactly do you call this way that she...
It's the Joker climbing out of the swamp.
There you go.
I call this gimmick infringement, because she stole Ra's al Ghul's thing of rising out of green pit.
True. Oh, God, you're right.
Ivy uses her new poison venom lips to smooch Glover and kill him. Guys, how close to the Poison Ivy in the comics is this character?
Depending on which one you read, especially by the end of it, not too far off. They've taken her in so many different directions. She's been an anti-hero now a lot. She's been a hardcore villain. She's been an eco-terrorist. I'm liking her right now, where she's kind of underground, like almost built an entire underground city and army and, you know, just let us live in peace or I'm going to pull up roots and pull Gotham to the ground. So all in all, she's not too far off of what they've done with Ivy. Doesn't mean they've done her well, but it's not straying too far from the source.
Yeah, Adam's right. The comics were really the big way that Ivy's been handled. She was in the animated series for quite a few episodes. They did some good stuff with her there. Mm-hmm. But all in all, this is, of the villains that they had done, this is certainly much closer than, say, the Penguin or Two-Face.
I mean, there's a great one, Gary. You would love it. She literally makes Superman fight Batman just by mind control.
That's crazy.
You know, she is powerful when they want to use her right, but DC decides that they're going to make a female as powerful as any of their male villains. They ain't got the balls for it.
So that's part of the issue with her character, though, is that she's always insanely powerful to a fault, I think, because writers, they don't know what her limit should be. And as a result, she kind of has Superman syndrome, where she can just do anything that the writers need her to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mr. Freeze is enjoying the hell out of a show on TV as Vivica A. Fox calls him perfect.
Come on, Steve.
See, this is the look I'd see in magazines and think, man, he looks cool. But then I see the context of what he was doing at the time. I'm like, wait a second. This is the guy I was looking forward to seeing?
To me, that's the problem. Any hope you would have had in this movie of him being menacing or a hardcore villain is gone the second that he's making people dance and sing Mr. Frickin' Snow Miser.
I'm Mr. Snow.
Like, it's gone.
This is the worst
fuck.
Because for Mr. Freeze, he's wearing slippers.
Yes.
and is taking a cigar, which are both designed to draw heat into your body. And this was here because Schwarzenegger got cigars delivered from John Bon Jovi on set.
Yes!
That was not in the script. It's sort of like Schwarzenegger became Marlon Brando from Dr. Moreau, where he has all these, speaking of Val Kilmer, where he has all these strange requests. Like, you know, I will only do the movie if you let me have these things. Speaking of Kill Bill, Vivica Fox is just here.
Yeah.
As her character's name is Misbehaving.
By the way,
which that's not even Pussy Galore would be like, oh, you fucking amateurs.
By the way, does this feel like a make good too? Because we have not one but two black characters in this, as opposed to what we were talking about last week, where they ixnayed two characters from the first two Burton films. Almost to me, kind of feels like a make good, even though both of them only have one or two scenes tops.
This is the problem that they don't understand. Mr. Freeze, his whole motive is to save his dying wife. So why does he have a side woman? This is, again, remaking Batman Forever. This is Drew Barrymore and Debbie Mazur.
Did you hear the story of Arnold and his maid?
This shit's almost prophetic.
Yeah, it does.
You use that $25 million salary to pay some alimony.
We are hearing of his plot to freeze Gotham, and then we cut. And then we cut to the other woman of the moment, Alicia Silverstone. Now, she shows up, and Robin is in just awe of her, as was I. I have more confessions to make as a 17-year-old at the time this was out. Here was another crush that lasted for years, and Adam remembers when Clueless was out, I had that Rolling Stone cover on my binder my entire senior year of high school. This woman was everything to me after those Aerosmith videos, and she was it. Clueless made Silverstone's career, and I feel in a lot of ways, more than anything else, Batman and Robin might have killed it. She would go on to do things like Excess Baggage, which, oh boy, is very weirdly titled given what she goes through in this production. But the It Girl was getting things leaked about her, like the costumers calling her Fat Girl. And let me just say, we can call Alicia Silverstone a lot of things in this. Fat is not one of them. I have read in many publications, and it was even on a superhero set, you gain an ounce, and you cannot fit in those fucking costumes. It is impossible to get into them. She was a growing girl at that time. She might have had what was called college weight, you know, the freshman 15, where you go to school and you're gaining a little bit of weight because it's a different lifestyle. This is the Hollywood look. It is disgusting the way this stuff got leaked to me. And she had what all girls have, and it was debilitating to her. I can feel it just watching this movie, boys. She looks like she is having no fun at all and is truly the one person here who is just trying to get through it.
You know what? I like her in this. I don't have a problem with Alicia Silverstone. I think at the time she was a really good cast. I got issues with who the character is in this movie, but I think Alicia Silverstone is well done. I'm not a fan of Clueless necessarily, though I do think it's funny because I think that they have a line in this movie a little bit later that is a complete reference to that movie, which cracks me up when they talk about Poison Ivy and he goes, "Nice stems," which is how we're introduced to her in that movie. She's good. She's fine. I don't think that they have enough to do for her character, but I think she does a good Bat Girl. What's amazing to me is they use this exact same costume later for Dina Meyer to be Batgirl on, I guess at that point it would have been UPN's Birds of Prey, which exact same costume, they just painted it up a little bit. But I like her, she's fine, and yeah, she may be able to, I don't know, have a piece of toast and swell up a little bit because at this point she's, what, 19? Yeah. Sorry, she's not 40 like Clooney or 35 like Chris O'Donnell trying to play a 19-year-old. You know, she actually is the age she's supposed to be in that movie. So it's unfortunate, and it's how women were treated at the time. It sucks and completely not fair to her, but I think she's a solid Batgirl for what she's allowed to do, which sadly isn't too much.
I want to give her every benefit of the doubt, but she has even proven this in interviews. She said she was, obvious joke in the world, she was literally clueless on the set. She had no idea what kind of movie she was in, and it shows. She looks perpetually confused throughout all of the scenes. And part of it is that she has to interact with everybody. She interacts with Clooney. She interacts with Chris O'Donnell. She interacts with Michael Goh. She fights Uma Thurman. Well, that's the thing. I think Batgirl is only in this movie because they needed someone to fight Poison Ivy. I have an issue with making her Alfred's niece, as weird as that is, because Commissioner Gordon is such a non-factor. It'd be so weird to all of a sudden introduce his daughter. and make him a character. Because this movie starts with him saying, hey, Batman, there's a new villain. You have to go fight him.
This is Commissioner Gordon's niece in the comics?
No, it's his daughter. It's his daughter's daughter.
Oh, wow. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Batgirl is Barbara Gordon.
Oh.
But as to Matt's point, yeah, making her this Commissioner Gordon's daughter would have been a problem because this Commissioner Gordon has not been a commissioner. He's kind of been, what was his name from the 66 series?
He's Chief O'Hara.
Like, that's really who he's been this entire time. But to me, it's Alfred Pennyworth has got a relative who they've brought into comics in the within the last decade. Julia Pennyworth, who I absolutely adore. But back here, it's a way to get her in. Not only in the movie, but literally in the house. And in the cave. Because God knows Alfred lets anybody in that cave.
She shows up to see her Uncle Alfred. And we are hearing Barbara's parents were killed in a motorcycle accident years ago. She is a part of the computer science division at her college, and Robin is obviously a 25-year-old who is going through puberty, as he's just totally taken with Barbara. Do these two get together in the comics?
Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, they do. Okay, so this is...
Oh, Dick Gordon and Batgirl? Oh, okay. Yeah. They are a power couple.
Okay. Barbara is apparently taken with motorcycles as she sneaks out of her room to ride one. We are hearing odd moments in the soundtrack as Ivy heads to Wayne's new publicity stunt of saying he's donating the world's most powerful telescope as he winks at the camera and says, just don't point it at my bedroom. They ask him if he's going to marry Elle McPherson, and he starts stumbling on his words. And let's not forget, and Adam, you mentioned this earlier, but this was Clooney's M.O. back then. He was a playboy who dated one woman after another. He went into this production dating Vendela, and he came out of it dating Elle McPherson. To say he was a poonhound would be a gross understatement.
He's only been married once, and that's to them all, only, what, the last 7 years, right? Yeah. Like, I think that's it. Yeah, Clooney was the, like, they call him the forever bachelor, and that's exactly who he is, or who he was. Elle McPherson, though, I mean, interesting choice, but she is a character that was in comics very, very early. When they introduced her, I want to say Batman was only 10 issues into its Batman run, and she was introduced as Bruce Wayne's fiance.
Oh.
So this character of Julie Madison goes way, way back to the 30s.
See, I didn't even hear her name.
Yeah, Julie Madison. She's a nothing character now, but that is a deep, deep pull that somehow they fished out to get her in there.
Ivy barges in and brings up the funding that was cut from her projects and proclaims that he is, quote-unquote, killing her. And Matt, this goes to right what you were saying. This is taken right from Batman Forever, correct?
Yes, it is. And it's made even dumber because there's no need for her to wear a wig. Because no one really knows what she looks
like.
Thank you.
And also, as they are walking away, she talks about her
evil plan.
They are still, it's most likely, in earsight, I have to expect someone to go, we can still hear you.
It's amazing. That was my very next note. She gives her plot to the camera.
Why is being in a trench coat? She looks like Raphael from the Ninja Turtles movie.
Either that or the Thing from the first Fantastic Four.
Like I have expected her to open the wig and be like, tell me you didn't pay money for this.
I don't know why that made me laugh, but I did hate it.
Didn't they put him in a fur coat in Nolan's film? I mean...
He's in a monkey suit later.
Yeah, monkey work. We cut to Freeze looking at old home videos as he punishes somebody who commits the cardinal sin of talking during the movie.
Waka, waka, waka.
We cut to more production as Batman sets a trap for Freeze, but it's not Freeze who shows up, it's Poison Ivy, and she's sending her venom Robin's way. And like a 25-year-old going through puberty, he seems to be in love. You know, we haven't talked about Chris O'Donnell much in this podcast because what really is there to talk about with him? You know, I think he's giving a bratty performance that would have been best suited for somebody about 10 years younger than him. Matt, you the one who defended O'Donnell last week. What do you think about Chris O'Donnell in this?
I don't think this movie does him any favors because he speaks in platitudes and cliches throughout this entire movie when it comes to living in a shadow and them being partners. It's not a very sophisticated relationship with how it's presented. And this is the movie where I think his age is actually more of a detriment than it was in Forever. Part of it is also Clooney does not have the imposing sense that I got from Val Kilmer. To do this, the movie after they become partners is very, it's very sudden. It's a bit of a change. I like the idea of Ivy manipulating the two of them because that's very aligned with her character. But I think Chris O'Donnell, you know, Robin in this movie is done dirty like almost everyone else.
ironically, he was one of the only people who came back for like DVD features and such when they released this on Blu-ray, probably about 10 years ago now, 10, 15 years ago. He definitely had bad things to say about the actual movie itself, but the experience, he said, was fun. So he doesn't actually hold this as harsh as a lot of people do. It's just funny seeing him talk about it years and years later.
I think one of the big problems you have is that Robin should not look like he is able to beat up Batman. Kind of what you get here. I mean, Matt said it. His age is becoming a problem in this one. I like the fact that his suit, that's a classic Nightwing suit. And, in fact, if you watch Titans, well, no, don't watch Titans. Look up and get a picture from Titans, because that show it's unwatchable. But the suit now looks like they literally took it from there, and 25 years later just posted it on that show. If he was Nightwing out doing his own thing in Bloodhaven and coming back, I think it would play a whole lot better. But him still being Robin Dick Grayson, so problematic in this one. It's too far.
Isley proclaims herself to be Poison Ivy, and there's a bidding war for her, with Batman and Robin getting into it before Batman shows the Bat card. Don't leave the cave without it.
Because there's nothing more PC than a woman auction that they have that Bruce Wayne is having at this
show. No shit. You know, I didn't even mention this at the beginning, but I had the fortune of watching this with somebody who had never seen this movie before. And by the time this scene happened, my girlfriend just kind of whipped out her phone. She's like, yeah, I'm pretty much tuning out after that. That was the most awful thing I've ever seen. Like, she was pretty much done after that. She sat there. She sat as I was watching it and taking notes and such, but she was pretty much done right after this joke was told.
You know, one of these women, when she's brought out in the famed Wayne Diamond, and they call it the Heart of Isis, and it's red and it's glowing. And for those that don't know, the Isis and Friends Hour that, you know, was the old TV show, that's another just deep cut kind of crossover from Isis, the DC character.
Interesting.
So it's amazing how, with all the things that they are doing in here and as cartoony as it gets, that somebody is throwing some really deep cuts every now and then, just flabbergasted me.
So the Bat credit card, that is a joke straight out of a Zucker Brothers. And there's no other joke like it in this movie. So it sticks out like a sore thumb. And this whole auction, it's overly produced. This is Schumacher being too in love with the aesthetics and the, you know, the fetishistic areas of Batman, because you got all these Tarzan looking guys.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they gave Poison Ivy Divine's eyebrows from Flamingos, because that's all I can think of.
Yeah, they are.
But she looks the part. The pixie dust or that crap looks okay. At this point, the movie's not about anything.
Yeah.
And this is the exact moment of the circus scene from Batman Forever. It's almost the same timestamp, same colors. The only difference is nobody dies, and I was hoping somebody bit the dust at this point, starting with Akiva Goldsman.
But what it does is it takes that scene from Forever when Edward Nygma is having his moment, and then Two-Face busts in and breaks it up. Right here, Ivy's having her moment, and Free shows up and busts it up. It's the exact same scene played in a different movie.
Adam, am I remembering this right? Weren't there Batman credit cards sold after this, as this movie was coming out? I seem to remember there being commercials where there were actual Batman credit cards.
I believe you could at least get it with that logo on it. I'm not saying I might have one somewhere in a drawer, Jesus. But it might be next to my WCW Bret Hart credit card that I still have sitting around in a drawer somewhere.
I remember when you got that.
For example. Yes, I did. But it's crazy because they found a way that, like, this was the commercial.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
This was one of the TV spots, you know, is don't leave home without it. I mean, now, great, I'm sure that American Express paid them $2 million to make that line in the movie, but oof. What bank goes ahead and issues it to the Batman? I mean, who's back at the credit card? And where'd he pull it out of?
That's a great question, too. You just...
Questions not to ask.
Does he have that in his utility belt? That's really weird. Freeze breaks up the cool party, and more fights ensue with Freeze busting up cops and running into Ivy, who tries her thermal dust on him to no avail. Now, is it just me, or do we have the same problem as last week? These two, they never team up in the comics or anything, correct? This is a weird team-up to me.
It makes no sense for these two to be together.
Yep, it was the dartboard of villains, and somebody threw a dart.
Yeah, because one of them is trying to freeze the Earth, the other one's trying to save it. So it's just
exactly
it's so bizarre. Freeze escapes, and there's a car chase with some weirdly, you know, we had a lot of bad things to say last week, but one thing we said, the effects in it weren't too bad. They're actually pretty good. Here, some of the model work on this car chase is just bizarre. They literally look like the racetracks that you get as a 10-year-old, and you're pushing the button and the cars go around the track. The special effects work here, as big as the budget is, doesn't seem like it's as good.
The landscape of Gotham also doesn't make any sense. Why are there statues in the middle of the street?
Exactly.
Yeah, watching some of the features and listening to Schumacher's, like, you know, we were coming up with designs and we were working on some of the builds for the city, and then they would come in and take our props so that they could send it to China to make the molds because the toys needed to start getting made a year and a half in advance. And, okay, you kind of know where some of it was playing and going. You're right. Part of it looks like they're slot cars on a track. The model work is not good. Mm. Not even up to the last one. With a bigger budget, it's amazing how much more shoddy some of these city scenes.
It's almost like all the money went into the costume that Arnold Schwarzenegger wears, or everything that has to do with Arnold.
Went into Kane.
Yeah, exactly. Batman turns off Robin's engine as Batman's the one who chases Freeze off the roofs and runs him down. Robin gets in Batman's face about taking all the glory as Bruce comes in and sees Alfred. And you know, one thing you can say about both other Batmans we've seen before is their repartee with Alfred has been good. I don't think there's a hint of chemistry even between Michael Goh and George Clooney. Like, they both just seem like they showed up on set, they did these scenes, and they left. Like, there's and we're doing a lot of ripping on Clooney's performance. And as me and Adam mentioned earlier, Clooney still rips this performance to this day. It's just weird watching this movie with a critical eye and taking notes on this and noticing these things, where later on Bruce Wayne's looking at him as he's on his deathbed and he's like, I love you, old man. And it's just like, dude, you're smiling as you're doing that. You're giving the exact look Adam detailed earlier where he has one arm up and he's just kind of looking at him with that grin. And it's just like, oh god, it just sticks out so much when you're watching this. Meanwhile, Robin and Barbara, they have a run-in, giving more lessons in bad chemistry. The Chris O'Donnell, at least the Silverstone chemistry, is more stuff that just doesn't work.
This is put together so weird and so poorly because we see her taking a motorcycle, then later on they have a confrontation in the motorcycle garage, and then he sees her later. But it's not telling a story that makes sense, really. It's kind of like, oh, we can't do this until we show this part, so throw it in here after this scene and throw this one here before this scene up until they get, you know, where they go to later. So it's just, yeah, whatever they cut out, supposedly they cut out a lot with her, it's really unfortunate because it does nobody any service.
We cut to Freeze being wheeled into Arkham Asylum, and we learn that he suffers outside the cold zone. Is this from the comics? If it's, like, sunny outside, he just doesn't function?
Yeah, this is canonical to more so Heart of Ice.
Okay.
That he cannot exist without sub-zero temperatures, which is why he has to wear the suit pretty much all the time.
Okay.
You also skipped over, this felt like Schwarzenegger's ego, where he said, I cannot let myself be beat by George Clooney on screen, so you have to cut to me just on the ground because he can't beat me in a fist fight on screen.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Mm-hmm. I'll say I love the look of this Arkham Asylum. Arkham comes from H.P. Lovecraft's work originally as an homage to it, so this is one creepy-ass Arkham Asylum building that we have. Different than what we've gotten before, different than any live action we've got. This is, I don't know, this thing's kind of freaky looking. I dig it.
Well, you know why Arkham Asylum kind of looks like that? It's because Jesse Ventura's working there back when I was the governor of Minnesota.
There we go.
You see, there was an echo.
Like, how pissed would Jesse Ventura have been? Like, man, we were in Predator together, of all things. And now you've got me in this shit. Like,
waiting for Carl Weathers to show up on the other side.
Come on, boys. Save it for the next series. We're almost there. More neon. God, what is up with all the neon here, including their faces? As Ivy and Bane, they take over the brand new fixer-upper lair that they're putting together.
I think this looks a shitload better than it did last week.
Really?
Yep. The way that at least they're fully painted and it's black light, as opposed to the entire downtown of Gotham being neon lit, being that it's here and it's enclosed, they're underground, I was going into this ready to rail against the Dayglow. It's here in this scene. I think they kind of look not horrible. I think they looked better than last week, and then it's over with. But I can't believe that I'm actually going into this going, huh, that's it. They don't look too bad, and I'm right past it.
Oh, boy.
I must have aged in the week that we did these reviews. This movie is like sensory overload for me. And I say that as someone who's both gay and colorblind.
We even have Looney Tunes sound effects. Did you guys hear those? Like, they're a barn as they're doing the fight.
Bong.
Yeah, it was really.
They flip.
Yeah. God, I couldn't believe
that. This movie might as well have Chuck Jones physics. with the way people get knocked over. It's Schumacher literally said it was a cartoon. That was what he would tell people before they started rolling. And for better or worse, that's what they made. But you got to wonder, it proves there is such a thing as too much.
Yeah.
As someone who did like the last movie, nothing is working for me here.
And this is all stuff you liked as a kid, right? We never even talked about whether...
Oh, God. Yeah. Just because it's, you know, it's the equivalent of sugary cereal, where it's all jittery and high, you don't have to think about it. But since you touched on Alfred, the problem with those scenes is that in Batman Forever, there are those serious subplots, but there's more of them. There's the Robin stuff. There's the Chase Meridian stuff. It's not serious per se, but the idea of being stalked by someone that wants to become you, there's something unsettling about that. Here, this is exclusively the only subplot that is treated with any semblance of dignity and subtlety, which makes it as distracting as the visuals and the writing that you're looking at. Because it doesn't fit to do a movie about family in something this garish and overly produced.
We then cut to Bruce and McPherson. They're having dinner, as well as Ivy finding a way into their conversation. And I'm sure this isn't the first nor last time Clooney has called somebody another girl's name.
Or Schwarzenegger.
Or Schwarzenegger.
Good call. I meant Maria.
All right, here we go. We get a cameo from Coolio, of all people, as Barbara gets herself into a motorcycle race. And as you guys said, I have read it as well. This was supposed to be the Scarecrow, eventually, if Schumacher had his way. I don't know.
Or if you believe Coolio.
Maybe Jonathan Crane just wanted some Gangster's Paradise.
Well, speaking of people who worked with Michelle Pfeiffer, that fucking Dangerous Minds video.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Oh, that's right.
Yeah, good call.
I don't understand why there's drag racing.
I know.
In a Batman movie, especially because it's Fast and Furious.
Yeah.
And why are there druids there? There's like a fucking Kiss gang.
Yeah.
OCP.
Yeah. This, speaking of people who are on the soundtrack, if the Smashing Pumpkins showed up, they would be the least absurd people.
And in 97, you probably could have got them in there.
Oh, yeah, they were.
Over the soundtrack.
Yeah, they are on the soundtrack. They're moving through the city with glowing green flames coming from the homeless barrels.
This movie is not short, and what it did not need is a 10-minute motorcycle race out of nowhere.
Yeah.
This is the scene where Batman drives up the wall, where it serves no story advancement whatsoever.
It's the porn effect, right? Uh-huh. It's the porn effect. You know, we haven't had an action scene for a while, so here you go. It's just like when you're watching porn, like you want sex like every other scene. Well, you get action finally. It ends with Barbara and Dick heading for the edge of the building and saving themselves just in time, with Dick giving the line, "So this is where you're hanging out." Oh, my God. Another time where Jen was like, "What the fuck are we watching?"
There's not a payoff to this.
Absolutely not.
Because, you know, they're romantically linked in the... From here on, you know, other than Dick gazing up at her at the beginning, there's not really a romantic spark between them at all in the rest of the movie. And whatever they think this does here doesn't come across romantic really whatsoever. You could have cut all of this. It's just, there's no reason, other than, I guess, to give her something to do where they can hide a stunt person, you know, under a helmet.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is probably 3 weeks of a second unit being filmed, you know, with nobody there. Ugh. Fuck, this was bad. This action scene grind everything to a halt in a movie that you boys already feel is ground to a halt.
Yeah. I got to be honest, boys. I was already checking my watch at this point. Hadn't seen this movie. It had been in a long, long time. It had probably been since me and Jack did that series years ago. It's a movie I don't revisit for obvious reasons. I am struggling to get through it here. As I'm pausing and taking notes, I'm like, how long am I going to drag this out?
This is the part where I had to pause it and go do something.
There you
else.
Go. It's pretty universal at this point. This is also when we learn that Alfred has McGregor syndrome, which is no real disease. It's actually just named after one of the producers of this movie. That tells you how the writing in this thing turned out. We cut to Freeze peeking at a snow globe.
And that right there, an image directly ripped out of Part of Ice. It? Like I said, just Bruce Timm and Paul Dini. I mean, you can't sue because of work for hiring everything else, same company. But when you get done with this, well, you won't have time before work. But you should watch that. You're going to be amazed at how many images they take right from it and the disservice that was done to Freeze. It's astounding.
As Ivy visits and Bane breaks him out, they learn that Freeze has escaped and is in cahoots with Ivy, who of course had nice stems. Right, Adam?
That's that
buzz, too. Those guys are only in here to diffuse any obvious homoerotic tension between these two. There's that moment when Elle McPherson is saying, like, look, I can't wait around forever. And she realizes, this motherfucker's gay. He's with the boy that's living with him.
You got the old man. You got this black leather I'm seeing everywhere. Yeah. Candles in this old house and these two men living. What the shit?
Well, if she saw the two of them together and saw the zero amount of chemistry between the two, she'd know right away. They walk into where Freeze's wife is as Freeze sets forth with his plan and freezes the police. And Batman and Robin, they fight Bane as Batman asks Ivy, why are all the hot ones homicidal maniacs? Which I guess is a reference to what, Catwoman, I guess?
Yeah. Gotta be.
God. And of course, Freeze, these police people are so incompetent that the minute he turns on the air conditioning, they just collapse.
Yeah.
Like, and that set looks like it's straight out of like the ice cream location. It looks like something right out of the Adam West.
Mm-hmm. It really does. Yeah. I got a lot of Batman 66 vibes while watching this. You know, you guys are pointing out a lot of stuff about the comics and things and the animated TV show, but I think in a lot of ways, Schumacher was also still trying to piggyback off that 66 vibe. You guys agree with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely was. Mm. But the difference is that this movie simultaneously looks expensive, but there are also parts where it looks remarkably cheap. Like all of John Glover's props early on in the movie, those look remarkably fake. These exteriors where it's just a warehouse with an exhaust vent that all the cops have to fall down. It's remarkable that this movie cost as much money as it did. And it looks as inconsistent as it does.
Robin is once again encountered by Ivy, and Batman interrupts the kiss, much to Robin's chagrin, and he pushes him into a bat of green goo.
OSHA, I'm telling you. Just need railings across this place.
You know what that ice cream would be called, right? Instead of Rocky Road, it'd be Rockin' Robin.
Oh, boy.
Jesus Christ. Tweet.
I knew this fucking podcast would be full of puns. Ivy tells Freeze that Batman was the one who deactivated his wife, which causes him to cry frozen tears and creates vengeance within him. So much vengeance that he now wants to start with Gotham and then take over the world with this Freeze ray.
How many takes do you think it took for Schwarzenegger to admit just that one tear?
I was thinking the same thing as I was watching it. I was thinking maybe the tear was CGI. By the way, I do love Batman and Robin fighting in tuxes. That was really weird. Like, they're fighting, they're yelling at each other, and they're both in tuxedos. You know? One thing you got to say about Schumacher, you'll always look good as you're fighting in these movies. We cut to the aforementioned deathbed scene as Alfred is dying of McGregor syndrome. Again, these scenes are not treated with any weight whatsoever. I feel like there are times when Schumacher does want to get deep. We said a lot about last week's movie, and Matt, you already said this, but you know there were times when he did actually slow that movie down a little bit and actually get into the mind of Batman. Here, there is no slowing down whatsoever. We're not taking in any emotion at all. We're just going from scene to scene.
Yeah, I mean, it's go, go, go. You mentioned, you know, it's a porn, and that's what it is. It's gonzo porn. It is just straight from one to another. It's not going to slow down. You don't know who's coming in to work on the copier. It's just... fuck on it. Let's go. Mm-hmm.
These scenes are befitting of a stronger movie, maybe a continuity that was more focused on Bruce Wayne and Alfred. Because really, the first three movies, he's there, but he's never the focal point that he should be. So all of a sudden, to force all these themes about fatherhood, just because he's dying of a disease that is the layman's term for plot convenience, are not given the weight that they should because they stick out so much in this overly theatrical movie that the minute they try to be serious, it's actually funnier. Mm-hmm.
It is unfortunate, though, because he is the one constant throughout all four of these movies.
That angle.
Go deserves better.
We cut to the telescope dedication ceremony as Ivy is once again there, sending Venom Commissioner Gordon's way. We then cut to Barbara trying to gain access to Alfred's computer. Puts in the word peg that Barbara is given access, to which I say, how the hell didn't this happen before? A three-letter password, really?
Three-letter password contains all the dirty secrets for Batman
exactly.
and Robin.
Exactly.
And it has to do with pegging. What?
Nice. Bruce and Dick, they're still fighting as Dick doesn't realize that Ivy is trying to kill him, and Bruce asks him to trust him again, and this is the line that Adam actually texts us today that I had to pause the movie. I was laughing so hard when he was just like, she's trying to kill you, Dick. I think that was the one delivery Clooney gave that I actually responded to.
Redheads will kill you. What can I say?
Yeah, he's not kidding. Freeze makes his way into the telescope, and he starts laying waste to the people, and Bane plants bombs. And Freeze says that revenge is a dish best served cold. And he says that hell freezes over. We're just going right into the puns here, boys. I mean, it's still not letting up.
It's crazy because when you have him making these puns and doing these scenes, there is nothing else in the frame but Arnold. And it's almost like they just built a set to come in and shoot mm-hmm. him on his own doing these puns. And that's all he did. Mm-hmm. You know, and knowing that anytime we don't see his face, it's not him. What the like, what was the reasoning behind it? But two things. One, not how a telescope works. Two, if you put a telescope in the middle of a city with bright lights, you ain't going to see shit.
Again, another movie where Bane is planting bombs as part of his plot.
Wow.
And again,
right.
Yeah, like, and also Freeze's suit is powered by lasers, which a laser is a heat device.
Yes.
No thought went into this.
And a laser and a diamond.
I need the diamonds for my hideout. And she goes, I'll help you grab your rocks. That's the one line that makes me laugh, unironically.
Oh, she throughout this movie, Ivy's got some line. Boys, my garden needs tending. I mean, she is hamming up some innuendos.
Did Nolan see this and just think, you know what, that's the one thing from this I'll take away, is I'll have Bane plant bombs around the city. Like Bane does here.
Oh, he also took the oversized trench coat and him ultimately being a hedge person for
yeah.
a woman.
You're not wrong. Wow.
It's all right. When we get to the Batman, we finish with bombs being placed around that city.
You're right.
Too.
Barbara finds her way into the Batcave, and Alfred's intruder alert does nothing but help point her way to a suit her size.
The intruder alert not only still works, it's been altered to be Alfred calling intruder alert.
So this is creepy.
Yes, I was getting to that, but go ahead. You go. Because I know I'm gonna agree with everything you say. Go ahead.
Well, I don't think Bruce Wayne would approve Alfred uploading his consciousness into the bat. Number two, he knows her exact sizes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's like, you know.
Uncle Alfie.
Is their last name Baratheon? Or Lannister? Like, what is the... When she says, suit me up, Uncle Alfred, I'm like, ugh. Like, it's very gross. Very. And again, Alfred's a dick in this movie where he's like, bring this Batmobile back in one piece. I would have been like, hey, dipshit, the Riddler threw a bag of bombs in the last car. That wasn't my fault.
You know what's amazing? She gets down to the Batcave, walks across freaking the turntable where the bat symbol, you know, has the Batmobile, and it's not until she's right in front of the computer and crosses a laser that it finally sends intruder alert. Bitch, she was in the fucking Batcave for 5 minutes already.
Robin makes his way into Ivy's lair, and when he finally realizes she's not just there turning over a new leaf.
Oh, you're proud of you put a star on that.
I really
one,
did. I was really looking forward to delivering that one. He gets to kiss her, and she finds out that he has put on rubber lips to prevent the poison from working its way through his body. O'Donnell's another one. His deliveries here are even worse than last time. Like, I thought maybe he was trying a bit last time. Here, he's another one. He just seems to be getting through it.
We talked about how disillusioned he was about doing the second one because he felt like they were making a toy commercial. And he talked about how it was a 2-year production schedule as opposed to 3. So everything felt rushed. But I love only the top part of his lips comes off.
Yeah, I caught that.
It looks like it's one unanimous piece, but they cared so little to not do a second take mm-hmm. where he takes the entire device mm-hmm. off.
Can she not reach back in and kiss him after he pulled it off? Do you have to get permission to kiss somebody for your deadly kiss to work?
Adam, you and I both know the answer to that question, sir.
Yeah.
Ivy traps Batman and Robin, but down comes Barbara as Batgirl to fight. Was anyone cheering at this?
I like... Yes.
Wow.
You know why? Because she drops through a skylight.
Okay.
And it is rare that you would actually have a female hero drop in the same way that your male hero would. So I appreciated that they let Batgirl crash in through a skylight.
But do you appreciate the fact that they don't give her a cowl? And Schumacher had to have her face revealed here.
I think the domino mask is always a stupid thing because you see everything other than the right around the eyes. That's why I'm a fan of Batwoman's, which is funny because she gets name dropped here. I love Batwoman's look where she's got a wig that's attached to her cowl, so her hair is completely different than her natural hair. But it's you don't hire Alicia Silverstone and then cover her up. You're not going to do it. We get plenty of FaceTime with Clooney, and Chris O'Donnell might as well not even have a mask on.
Yeah.
So it never bugged me. I like the cowl look generally, but the domino mask, I'm okay with it.
Her costume is fine. I have no issues with the aesthetics of these costumes at all. I think they all look good. But you couldn't have a better line than you're about to become compost.
Mm-hmm.
I like this fight, surprisingly. It's okay, but I don't understand how Ivy loses control of that giant Feed Me Seymour plant that she had.
It is Audrey, too. That's my note.
Ivy says the line that she said when she pulled the plug on Lady Freeze before sending her on her way, and then introduces herself to Batman and Robin. This is when Lisa's just right in front and center, finally. Meanwhile, Freeze is planning a deep freeze of Gotham, and his plan helps stop a dog from peeing at a fire hydrant. Come on, this is a Michael Bay joke right here.
This is Michael Bay's humor mixed with Roland Emmerich's The Day After
there
Tomorrow.
There you go.
Where Jake Gyllenhaal has to outrun the cold.
Yep.
God, I remember.
Batman gives a countdown as they make their way into where Freeze is. They set up some heaters as Batman figures out how to turn off the telescope. They fall as Batgirl rescues Robin. But Bane finds them as a fight with Freeze and Batman happens. Batgirl and Robin, they kick off the super serum supply as Batman tells Freeze the heat is on, and then he fully reverses the super telescope. Did I really just read that sentence?
Yeah, that's what it says. And you also forgot they left Bane to die.
Yeah!
He's depowered. They don't know he's going to die.
Oh, Adam. Adam's going to be the one who defends this.
He's just deflating.
Freeze turns on the bombs as he rolls off and yells at Batman to freeze in hell as Batman falls with two other doctors and leads them to safety. Batman says it would take a computer genius to turn off the telescope, to which Batgirl and Robin are like, yeah, we're here. We'll take care of it. Is Batgirl a computer science whiz in the comics?
Eventually, okay. when she becomes Oracle, the whole other conversation we'll be having once we get to Birds of Prey.
Now, here's another question I had, and we didn't touch on this when we were actually introducing Lisa Silverstone. We were too busy talking about the thing said about her, but she is British in the comics, isn't she?
No, Barbara Gordon's American.
Oh, she is American. Okay.
It's weird that for being Alfred's niece, she is not English at all.
Okay.
There is a Julia Pennyworth who's British in the comic books that has been around the last couple of years, known as Penny, too.
All right. Everything in the city is melted, including the dog who tried peeing on the fire hydrant. Freeze begs Batman to kill him as Batman shows him the video of Ivory proclaiming to be the one who pulled the plug, all of which are shown with very familiar camera angles. So apparently Batman had the exact camera angles to which we saw it before. This is the impetus for Freeze to give Batman the cure to McGregor syndrome. Does he have a heart in the comics? Like, is he actually all evil, or is there some more dimensions to him?
Depending on who's writing and who plays him, or who's writing him and what they decide to do. Scott Snyder recently did a one-shot that was just completely vicious and evil and kind of took a Nazi turn, but a lot of times he cares about one thing, and that's helping find a cure for his wife. And outside of that, as long as you're not in his way, he's not out to hurt or kill you. He's got a plan. If he can help you and get his stuff done, yeah. In the way of a heart and everything else, it's tough because he's supposed to be so cold and emotionless, like no empathy, no sympathy. So he's literally a block of ice. So I go with it, but it depends on which depiction you're going with.
But I hate how even this scene, they have to end with a joke where he says,
two of these and call me in the morning. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, these suits that they show up with at the end, I don't know where and how they find time to do this costume change. But suddenly they show up with these black and silver suits that look like a freaking toy variant that, you know, an exclusive to a certain store. Because, oof, there's one reason for these suits redesign, and that's for a wave two of toys.
The '90s were all about frozen tips. Frosted tips.
Yep, and frosted nips in this one. That cowl on Clooney at the end with those weird little fins like shaved into the side of the ears is the worst cowl out of any Batman iteration they've ever done.
The cure, of course, works, and Alfred is back on his feet. The storm is averted, and Ivy is shown plucking a rose, saying, he loves me not, as Freeze shows up to tell her winter has finally come. So, here we go. Pre-Game of Thrones, he's proclaiming winter to arrive. We see Bruce get lambasted for his housekeeping skills, and Bruce tells Robin he could handle it when he was falling without Batman having to save him, so Batman finally trust him. Adam, you seem to be responding to these jokes a lot more than me and Matt are, which is surprising to me, honestly.
When Alfred shows up and makes that, I found that heartwarming and I laughed. But again, that one, you know what I thought of? I hate comparing it to something else. There's a brilliant page to a comic. The art's done by Mitch Storadz, who's fantastic. And Bruce is sitting on the couch across from Swamp Thing, who's sitting on another coffee table between them. Alfred has to sweep up behind Swamp Thing because he's freaking shedding leaves. it's an amazing moment, but it's what that made me think of, that, you know, when Alfred shows up, of course the first thing he's going to talk about is, you know, keeping the house clean or something. I liked it, you know. I may not like the way they've treated Alfred in this, but his response back, and that's his first thing, that seems right. That, yeah.
The three of them grab hands and proclaim themselves to be partners, to which I hear perhaps the worst line of this movie, a line I had completely forgotten about, which is Alfred saying they're going to need a bigger cave. So on top of everything, we get a...
And Garrett Brace's TV.
He ends it with a fucking Jaws callback? And that's the end of Batman and Robin.
Oof.
Mercifully. Oh boy, that was 2 hours and 5 minutes, boys. Scale of 1 to 10... What do we give Batman and Robin? I'll go to Matt first.
I will never be a proponent of child abuse, but I wish I could go back to my 6-year-old self and turn off the TV. All in all, this movie is well warranting of its reputation. It is shockingly bad in almost every way. So I'm not going to articulate those points anymore because the movie it's been a punchline for decades. Now, having said that, there's a lot of discussion about, is this the worst superhero movie of all time? And I will say no. I think there have been movies that have been more either unwatchable or even further down the totem pole as far as being of quality. Because you could say that this movie's at least shot decently, and it's got some vibrant colors if you're into those sorts of things. So I don't think it's the worst comic book movie of all time. It's definitely in that conversation. If it's the worst movie we review on this retro, I can't even say that. So that puts me in an odd position. I don't think this is a movie that I would give something like a 0 to. Because to me, that's for the worst of the worst. And I don't view it in that regard. And as I've gotten older, I don't harbor the resentment towards it. Because we needed to get to this point to get something like Batman Begins. And if that was the sacrifice we had to make, then you know what? I think it was worth it. There's some marginally fun moments, but it's catered so much to a specific audience that it's pretty much inaccessible outside of being a child. And that's how I feel about it now, despite my overwhelming sense of nostalgia. So I'm going to land on the same score, Garrett, I think you gave Batman Forever. It's a 3 on 10. It's very bad, but there is some kind of unified vision. You know, Schumacher said, I want to set out and make a cartoon, toyetic cartoon. He succeeded at that. But I don't think it's what this franchise needed or warranted. But like I said, I have seen worse, especially in the 25 years since this. So I'm going to land on a 3. I can't bring myself to go any lower.
Boy, I bet we're going to be getting to it too. Adam, you've been more kind to this movie than the two of us are in this podcast. What do you give Batman and Robin, sir?
Going into this movie, I never would have thought that I would have been as kind as I've been to this movie. But you know what? The first few minutes of this movie let you know what it is. I think of something like, don't come at me, people. I think of something like Guardians of the Galaxy. I am not a fan much of that first movie. I thought that it was unfocused and had great moments, but really just was all over the place. Acting was all over the place. Shot was all over the place. And I felt the second one knew what it was so much more. I feel like Schumacher coming back knew what he was making more than he did last week. He's making a live-action toy commercial cartoon, and that's kind of what this movie is. That doesn't mean it's good, but it at least knows what it is and kind of revels in it. It's not Batman 66 because that was so campy enjoyable, but this isn't the steaming pile that I thought I was going to walk into thinking that it was and that I was prepared for. And maybe my low expectations mean that I didn't hate it as much. Because I had such low expectations for George Clooney, I wasn't as disappointed as I was last week with Kilmer, I think. That doesn't mean that this is good, but it's watchable. And surprisingly, I found it an easier watch than Batman Forever. And I can't believe I'm saying that. And that may switch on another time, but I knew what I was getting from beginning to end. And slapsticky silly, I can understand why kids would have been all over this. I can understand why 6-year-old Matt would have been enjoying this movie because, yeah, it's Frosted Flakes. And maybe when you're older, you need some Honey Bunches of Oats. But, you know, when you want some Frosted Flakes and that's what's on the box, at least you know what you're getting. Clooney's not a good Batman. I thought he looked good as Bruce Wayne. Alicia Silverstone, definitely serviceable. I wish they did her better. Garrett wishes he did her better himself. Uma Thurman is delightful most of the time. She's just, you know, she's having fun. Bane is horrible. You know, there's no doubt about that. But am I going to watch it again? Probably not. But I'm not watching Batman Forever. I can't probably either. I watch Batman Returns at the beginning of every Christmas season, and that's only because of the theming of it. I'm not going to go quite as low as Matt, but because I had a more enjoyable time than last week, I'm going to give it just the slightest nudge above it. So I'm going to give this one a 4.5 when I gave Forever a 4.
Boy, I was scared there for a second. I thought you were going to go above 5. And me and Matt would have to have a serious talk if that happened.
Ooh.
You had me, Adam. You had me until you said this thing is watchable. This movie is not watchable. It's a fucking jumbled mess. And its reputation is so prestigious it that if people were coming in and watching it for the first time, like Jen, for example, she sat down with me and she was all set to watch this with me. And by, I would say, the 30-40 minute mark, she was already grabbing her phone. She was checking her Facebook messages. She was getting on the phone with her family. She was done. It's just one of those movies that it's a chore to get through for me. You know, partly because Batman was a huge part of me loving comics as a kid. Batman and Superman, which we'll get to next year. Superman more so. But Batman just reignited my love for comics and comic book movies. I got about an hour into this and I was like, fuck, how much longer is this movie? And I cannot endorse a movie like that. I cannot endorse a movie that has every single decision be the bad one. I'll tell you one person I feel sorry for in this whole thing. It's Joel Schumacher, because he seems like he set out to make a different movie than he made. He paid for this movie in so many ways throughout the course of the rest of his life. He unfortunately has left us. But he is another one who, in the commentaries and everything that was released about this movie, he was like, look, I'm sorry. I did Batman fans wrong. I just did what was put in front of me. I think this movie is just a monstrously bad film. Its reputation as the worst comic book film does precede it. I will go out and say it is the worst comic book film we will see in this entire retrospective. Not just this one, but future ones that we're going to cover. It's bad. It's tough to get through. Performances are tough to watch. Alicia Silverstone, another one I just felt bad for watching this. Like, she just looks like she is not having fun. Uma Thurman, one of my number one crushes. I think she's having fun. She has embraced this movie's reputation, but I do not embrace her performance. There's nothing about this movie I can endorse, so I will go even below Matt. I take that back. The worst comic book movie we have seen was New Mutants. I'm not going to go 0. I can't go that low.
No.
But I can give it
Yeah.
Go back and listen to that podcast. You will hear my exact thoughts on that. That is the worst thing I've ever had to sit through for this show. Comic book-wise, I will give this a 2. It's... say it! It is just... it is not a fun watch, and by the time it was over, I was exhausted. I went and lay down and took about a 2-hour nap after I was done. I was so exhausted from this movie. So yeah, 2 out of 10 for me. That does it for the Joel Schumacher, Tim Burton years of Batman. As I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, this movie in particular just killed this franchise for a number of years. But good news, we were finally able to get a Catwoman film 7 years after this. I don't know if I can give a lower score than what I gave this movie, but next week we'll test that theory if I remember anything from what I saw the first time I watched this movie. Adam, what are you expecting next week?
Wait, I gotta watch that?
Yes, thing? We covered this. Yes, we are covering Catwoman next
Damn
week.
Damn it. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. I'm expecting to see Halle Berry and go, man, she looks good. Yeah, no, she doesn't even look good. I got no expectations for that movie. I haven't seen it. Never watched it. In theaters, at home, nothing. Oof, no. It's, you know what? I was going to watch it once upon a time when I thought that I was going to do a back-to-back with Elektra when that movie came out, and I never made it through that movie, so I never bothered with Catwoman. I got Garrett Collins' New Mutants expectations when it comes to Catwoman next week.
Wow, party pooper much. Goudreau as the man who really did not like Batman Returns. We're going to see that character come back next week, the Catwoman character. Or is that a different character? We'll talk about that next week. But, sir, what are you expecting when we finally get our Catwoman movie?
I'd rather be spayed and neutered than have to watch this movie. I felt like I lived 9 lives the first time I watched Catwoman, but that was... probably like 2000. I've only seen it once. I saw it in theaters and have never seen it
since. Oh, wow.
It has been almost 20 years since I have watched Catwoman, so it's not that I have no expectations. I'm more wondering what I'm going to think of it as a lover of bad movies, but also as someone who hates the idea of taking the name and doing something that has little resemblance to the source material, which I distinctly remember this movie. Not even calling her Selina Kyle. I could be wrong on that, but I do remember a whole bunch of shit about this movie pissing me off, and it ruined my love of basketball.
I can't wait to discuss that scene.
This is a 3-point shot where the death of basketball for me.
But that's all next week. Until next week, the podcast has frozen over. Thank you, boys.
Good, his was better.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast.
I read your work. Insightful. Naive, but insightful.
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
Ooh. Talk about your cold shoulder.
Just a note, the 3 Chris Nolan films are not going to be part of this retrospective as they were covered by Matt and Garrett on the binge movie Aftertaste just a few years ago.
Never rub another man's rhubarb.
To hear those takes, please head over to www.bingemedia.net.
Okay, go ahead. Intimidate me. Bully me if it makes you feel big. I mean, it's not like you can just kill me.
Actually, it's a lot like that.
The Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Tonight's forecast, a freeze is coming.
Voice narration by Adam.
I hate when people talk during the movie.
Edited by Garrett.
That miserable, waddling mountebank of a bird. He couldn't finish a bag of popcorn.
The Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast is for review and discussion and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
So many people to kill, so little time.
Bob, gun.
All right, Goudreau. You ready?
Yeah, my first Father's Day as a parent.
Oh, your first Father's Day as a father. How's that going?
Good, until we said, hey, let's do Batman and Robin today.
Bob, gun.
Uma Thurman was... frickin' Uma Thurman. So, you know, at least on the standpoint of, hey, we're going to get more of what we got before. Yeah, I mean, I would have gone into this pretty dang excited.
Adam, I don't know if that, is that you that has a ton of interference going on over there?
I sent a message
there?
Saying, Adam, there's some kind of buzzing on your end.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there? Shoot.
There. Yeah. I think whatever it is, I think. Oh, there it goes again. What is that?
Is it?
Is that your connection?
It sounds like feedback.
I think it might. Yeah, it sounds like feedback from somewhere.
Let me restart. Okay, I'm sorry. Let me just restart.
Okay, that's fine. No, it's okay.
I'd rather get it straight once and not have the problem throughout. Let me restart. I'll be right back.
Okay. All right. No problem. Me and Matt can talk.
Wait to freeze the conversation.
Gonna put the chill on these.
It's okay, restart. Me and Matt can talk. Oh boy.
Well, I'm glad that started now before we got too deep into this.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's why I wanted to nip it. I'm like, at first I thought it might have been me, and I'm checking, and then all the noise was coming from his end. I was like, uh-oh, this isn't good.
Bob, gun.
But the way he handled this is why he's a star.
You know what's amazing?
We see... Go ahead.
Go ahead, Matt.
Matt, or Adam, you go ahead and go first.
Oh, sorry, I was going to say, what's amazing to Clooney is...
Bob, gun.
Apparently, Schwarzenegger's big rival, Stallone, was doing everything in his power to try to get this role.
Oh.
The studio likely said no, because much like Schwarzenegger, his career was on the down. It was on the avalanche of something, and he could not outrun it on his skis.
Yeah, Schwarzenegger thought he'd be above the law for Batman.
Oh, my God. They're just going to keep coming.
Bob, gun.
Freeze gets him with his freeze wet, or freeze gets him with his freeze ray, easy for me to say, and calls him Bird Boy. Let me say that again, because that's going to be a blooper.
Bob, gun.
She is not a good fit as Poison Ivy. How do we feel about Uma Thurman in this, boys? Boy, awkward silence. It does not even describe this. Matt, you go ahead and go, since I went to Adam first before.
Oh, boy.
Bob, gun.
Do you know who John Glover is? Because he is a major villain in the DC Universe. Dr. Woodrue. That is the Floronic Man.
Oh, boy.
One of the oldest villains and one of Swamp Thing's biggest, baddest adversaries.
Oh, boy. Do we have to do Swamp Thing now?
Come on. Adrian Barbeau.
And Wes Craven. Oh, my.
Bob? Gun.
This is Commissioner Gordon's niece in the comics?
No, it's his daughter. It's his daughter.
Oh, wow. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Batgirl is Barbara Gordon.
Oh.
Yep.
Adam, you have problems with this?
Watch the list me and Matt sent you.
I know. I need to get through. I'm sorry. I've had company the last week. I'm sorry. Wow, that's crazy to me.
Bob, gun.
I'll say I dig the look of this Arkham Asylum because Arkham was taken. Ah, fuck, never mind. I just had a brain fart. Sorry.
That's okay.
Not Tolkien. Oh, my God. Old Gods.
Jack Kirby.
Shit, Cthulhu. No, Cthulhu.
H.P. Lovecraft.
Thank you. Arkham... I'm going to do that again.
Bob, gun.
There's nothing about this movie I can endorse, so I will go even below Matt. I take that back. The worst movie we saw was... God damn it, Matt. What was the name of that final X-Men film?
Dark Phoenix?
No.
Oh, New Mutants. Yes.
The worst comic book movie we have seen was New Mutants. I'm not going to go zero.
Bob, gun.
So yeah, 2 out of 10 for me. Adam, what else do you have to say?
I have to say that New Mutants is not even in the bottom half of the X-Men movies. You are out of your mind. I listened to that show back then, and I finally get a chance to stick up for it.
What a horrible, horrible movie that was.
We will have words one day, my friend. No. Oh.
Believe you will find this Death Star fully operational.
So,
no movie with a freaking God damn it! Never mind, I lost it. Go ahead. Okay.
All right. So that covers the Joel Schumacher / Tim Burton years of Batman. As I mentioned in this podcast, this is pretty much
Birthday Girl,
huh?
That was the other movie I saw with Nicole Kidman. That Birthday Girl. That's the one for those that listened last week. Told you I saw one more movie with Laura.
Oh, my God. Jesus Christ. You have been the...
You're welcome.
You have been working too many hours because you are the butt of every single blooper this fucking show will have.
Bob, gun.